Folks, we're back. The podcast returns after a week-long hiatus. Unfortunately, I believe for many of you, if not all of you, it turned into a two-week hiatus. We recorded an episode mid-August, like the 17th, I believe, date-wise, something like that. And for whatever reason, that didn't post. So that had our thoughts on like the Trenton Flowers Louisville situation, the Noah Farrakhan West Virginia situation, et cetera, et cetera. So we're working on getting that posted. It's pretty evergreen content. So if you guys are looking for it, it should be there, hopefully, in the next week or so, or the next few days. But if it doesn't pop up for whatever reason, I think our thoughts were that Kenny Payne is trending towards a inevitable demise in what could be a pretty ugly year for the Louisville Cardinals. So, Brad, we took a week off for both of us actually in the process of moving. We're too far afleet, but I changed neighborhoods in Chicago. You relocated as well in Mass. So good to catch up, and we are 10 weeks away from college basketball. What a beautiful thing.
In regards to Kenny Payne, too, it is funny because I was looking back when I did an exercise last year. It was probably post-NBA draft, like early July, maybe, of 2022. And I just wanted to rank the high major coaches just to get some perspective. Nothing to be shared on Twitter and get my head bit off or anything, but just like in terms of where you view these guys and stuff. So I was looking back on that this morning, and last July I had Kenny Payne as the worst high major coach in the country. And as crazy as it sounds, I mean, his stock has only dropped from that. I mean, like, you were the worst. The perception was you were the worst high major coach in the country last year. And then you did, like, significantly worse than expected.
Well, that was – I mean, that initial take, Brad, was presumably heavily informed by the fact that
– the roster
– go out on the roster construction, correct?
Yeah, and now looking back on how I ranked last year, I think I did too much weight on resume. Like I remember – having Jim Boeheim super high just because, like, you look at his resume and, like, he's in the Sweet 16, like, every year, and, like, 2 years before the, you know, before his demise, he was in a Final Four, basically. Maybe it's 2 or 3 years. I don't remember exactly. But, like, he's just so accomplished. And when I was going through it this year, I did a little more balance of accomplished versus would you want to run your program versus how's it looking now?
Well, I will say on the Kenny Payne front, I do think I will look back on my takes last year of being, like, mildly optimistic Louisville would, like, find their way to the NIT based on talent and energy from Kenny Payne being, like, one of the dumbest things I've ever said.
Well, I was reading Sam Vecini's article about Trenton Flowers this morning, and he was like, you know what? Like, it's kind of good that he left Louisville because the roster construction was terrible for him, where, like, he can't shoot, and, like, he likes to get into the paint, and they were going to probably play him next to two of Hunley Hatfield, Dennis Evans, and J.J. Traynor. And, like, Trey White's not, like, a marksman of any kind, and Sky Clark is, like, ball dominant pick and roll, so, like, the whole roster was still even mismatched more than the people like us who maybe haven't only have a superficial understanding of some of the newcomers. The people who really dig into the film were like, no, this was not going to change.
Yeah, I think things are not great at Louisville. We've got a few kind of news peggy type things more recent that we have to touch on. We're also going to touch on Brad's list of you had the good branding for it, but I kind of view them as last chance guys.
Yeah, so I call them my now or never guys. So I broke them into four categories: star reputation, new scenery. Are we sure they're good? And addition by subtraction. So I made a list of now or never guys, and I binned them into those four different categories.
Well, you can look forward to that here later in the episode. Got a few news pegs to hit. Brad, I think we can start with a few very well-traveled college basketball players, neither of whom have actually played a game in college basketball. First being Dior Johnson. Dior Johnson, no longer with the Pitt basketball team. His journey has been bizarre. 9 or 10 different high schools, commits to Oregon and Syracuse. Now at Pittsburgh, gets a domestic violence charge, redshirts as a freshman, goes to Europe with them in early August, and now is no longer with the team. The circumstances here, not overly clear. I've seen some kind of speculation that it's somewhat related to the domestic violence arrest just now rearing its ugly head once again. Some speculation just about playing time, and he was in competition with Jalon Lowe, Carlton Carrington, two freshmen, for minutes at the point guard spot. Either way, I mean, it's the latest in a very bizarre career saga for a guy who, you know, I don't think people totally remember. Like, Dior Johnson was supposed to be, like, that dude in 2022, right? Like, before Amani Bates, really, even. It was Dior Johnson. He was having dinner at LeBron's house, hanging out, like, eating Taco Tuesday, and had huge following, recruited by everybody. Got to the point where, you know, I think the clearest thing is, like, the fact that his recruitment was Pitt and Mississippi State when he was, and I think Washington State was the third, when he left Oregon. I think that was a pretty good illustration of, like, this guy's got some real issues and is such a challenge to deal with. And it doesn't seem like the path is becoming any clearer. I think the other thing too, I think that was obvious when we saw that list, was like, how good is he actually? Like, yes, he's talented, yes, he can create, but, like, was he going to be worth the trouble? And it seemed like he only was worth the trouble if you were a, you know, desperate team that had no other means of talent acquisition. Pitt wound up saving it without Dior, but I'm curious, like, what the next step is here in this basketball journey, because, I mean, this story has been very, very sad. To see his career go off the rails. And, like, I'm not totally convinced he's getting another high major shot.
Well, here's where I stand, right? Like, if this departure, because like what you said, I saw somebody suggest that the departure is due to the original incident, and they just decided that the PR is bad, so we'll just cut him loose. If that's a story where there was no additional infraction, this was not Dior's choice, they just said, you know what, we've reconsidered that year suspension and we're going to turn it into an expulsion, I don't think that that's fair.
Agree.
We don't know that for certain, you know, if that's the actual story or not. Yeah, 10 different high schools, I saw Anthony Wright saying 10 different high schools. Then there was a Syracuse commitment. He signed with Oregon. You mentioned the final three schools were Washington State, Mississippi State, and Pittsburgh. And the fact that on this foreign tour where he was playing and in the mix, it certainly seemed like Carrington was ahead of him and maybe even Lowe too, at that point guard position, begs the question that you mentioned is Dior Johnson actually good anymore? I mean, when you keep moving around and switching that much, like, there's no stability. How are you developing?
Right. Well, particularly given the fact, like, the appeal of Dior as a young player was, yeah, this guy knows how to – he's a creative ball handler. He's fun to watch. He's an explosive scorer. But, like, for him to be a point guard, right, for him to be a guy that leads an offense, that requires real, like, player development, and he just hasn't had that. was away from the team in points last year. You know, I saw a Pitt writer or blogger or whatever say something to the extent that, like, Dior discouraged other, you know, big name players from coming in the portal because they were afraid of Dior. And I was like, okay, well, that was really stupid of any big name player to not come because Dior Johnson was blocking your route. Seems like classic kind of fan hard feelings for not getting kids you wanted to get.
Yeah, who but are like, these big name players?
Joe Girard, I don't know.
That is a mighty compliment to Joe Girard, but
I mean, Joe Girard's like a 1,500-point college scorer. Let's
no, he's good, but I don't know if he's someone who, you know, you should be shaking your fist at the sky if you're a Pitt fan. Like, oh my God, we could have had Joe Girard. He's no Nigel Williams-Goss or Dedrick Lawson or anything, but continue.
But yeah, like so the practical impacts here are this: we don't know that Dior Johnson's actually that good. Dior Johnson's brand him alone made him the theoretical inside track to the starting point guard job. The fact that Pitt now really does not have a traditional point guard on the roster that's not a freshman is very scary. I think it really caps the upside of this team because I really like them 2 through 5, right? Like, Blake Hinson's a really good player, was essential to their NCAA tournament run last year. Is very experienced. I think he's probably a 6th or 7th year guy in college basketball at this point. You know, he's a 15-6 guy a season ago. You know, bring in Ishmael Legette, who I think there's some questions about what he did to contribute to winning on some bad URI teams, but the numbers don't lie. I mean, he averaged 16-6-2 assists a game last year for an A-10 team. You have Zach Austin, who's one of the best athletes in the country, was a very good player for High Point, great defender, versatile. And you have these, you know, this stable of bigs with the Diaz Graham brothers, as well as Federico. So you have to like them 2 through 5. But the fact that no one seems to be getting the inside track to the starting point guard job, and you have a combo guard in Carlton Carrington winning some of those reps in the overseas trip, and then Jalon Below, who is a good recruit, but not an elite recruit. Jalon Below is 86 nationally in the composite. That's scary that that's your point guard spot.
Yeah, I mean, I love the Pitt front court. You mentioned, you know, Hinson, the Graham brothers, Federico, and then Papa Conte. I mean, that's a very good 4 and 5 group. Austin and Legette, they're probably good enough, but they don't really move the needle as the starting 2 and 3 in the ACC, right? Like, they're probably ACC level starters, but not if you're going to be pushing for an NCAA tournament bid, you wouldn't think.
Right. Well, like, right. Here's the easy question. Who's the second best player on Pittsburgh?
The second best player on Pittsburgh might be Guillermo Diaz Graham, you think?
It almost has to be, right? Because if your second best player is Legette or Austin, how good are you?
Could be a nice jump from Diaz Graham. I mean, both the twins were seen as, you know, skilled offensive players that they didn't get to show a ton. As freshmen, they were so skinny and, you know, played more down the stretch. But I think probably the ideal outcome, right, is Hinson's obviously your best player, and then maybe Zach Austin and Legette can both put up, you know, 11, 12 points a game. But it's going to come down to this point guard spot where it seems like even if Dior was there, that was not the greatest scenario there for Pitt. Now they're going to just split between the two freshmen. It's a real roll of the dice. We'll see if they can. I mean, Iowa State got great mileage out of Tame and Lindsey last year. You know, every now and then a freshman point guard is steady enough. But I think predicting Pitt, I think you're putting them 12 or 13 in the ACC.
That feels a little low, but I also think we do have to remember, like, Pitt was not a top 50 KenPom team last year. We have no reason to trust Jeff Capel based on previous history. Last year was relatively an aberration.
I mean, five through 13-ish in the ACC is all jumbled together.
And they won a lot of close games last year.
Like, I think this year I have Clemson at 5, and I have Boston College at 13, and I don't think there's a huge difference there.
You go through league play with Pitt. They're 14 league wins. We have by 8 against NC State, by 2 against Syracuse, by 2 against Carolina, by 3 against Virginia, 11 against Georgia Tech, fine. 21 against Louisville, of course. But 2 against Wake, 3 against Miami, 1 against North Carolina, 34 against Louisville, again. 8 against
FSU. 34 and 21.
You know, they played a lot of close games. And even, like, you know, in the NCAA tournament, they beat Mississippi State by a point. So this thing could have went a lot differently with a little less close game luck. And they were a positive luck team per KenPom a season ago. So something to keep in mind.
And speaking of the ACC, I was just looking at the rundown of ACC coaches today. It is really kind of scarily light. Like, we have Tony Bennett, obviously national champion, but I think his stock has taken a bit of a – I mean, not like a cratering hit, but, like, he's nudged down, I think, stock-wise. You know, after these past couple of years, haven't been able to replicate the same level of kind of, I guess, system dominance, we'll call it, where they've just been good or they've just kind of been hanging on around the bubble. Right, there were 2 years of hanging around the bubble and 2 years of good, I think, since the national championship. Does that sound right?
Yes, and that's with the context that their two good teams both had random NCAA tournament losses, one because of the COVID and one because of the Furman.
And then you get Larrañaga, who's obviously a very good coach, but, you know, he's not like they built, like, a consistent level of regular season success. I mean, they've had a couple of nice tournament runs. They've had, you know, great teams dating back to Shane Larkin and Kenny Kaiji up to, you know, last year they made it very far. But, you know, that's not a team that's pulling in top four seeds regularly. And then the other big coach, Leonard Hamilton, has a resume but has been falling off a little bit.
And two of those three coaches are retire any day now.
Yeah, they're like in their mid to late 70s, right? So that's why I had texted you earlier today that is Micah Shrewsbury the fourth best coach in the ACC? And you said, no, Shire. And then that gets to the whole kind of philosophical debate of you're evaluating these coaches and how do you weigh the difficulty of the job versus the success?
Yeah, it is an interesting conversation. I think particularly with someone who has never been out of the ecosystem, it's particularly challenging. Like, we have no knowledge of what John Shire is as a coach outside of Duke. So how do you compare that to Shrewsbury, who has, you know, a very successful run at Penn State? I don't know. But, yeah, I mean, look, it's no secret that the league needs some of Damon Stoudemire, Shrewsbury, Autry to hit, and it needs to really hope that, you know, Hubert Davis and Shire prove to be good coaches, or that Carolina moves on from Hubert relatively quickly, and that Louisville moves on from Kenny Payne.
Yeah, it is a great opportunity for Stoudemire. Like, there's definitely a world. I mean, they have a great backcourt this year with Amari Abram and Miles Kelly. They've, you know, added Kosi Reeves from Florida. They got Dellen Coleman back. They got Tafara Gabare, who's one of the best athletes in the country. Like, they could, you know, with that kind of bloated middle in the ACC, you know, Georgia Tech could be this year's Pitt, right, where they make the NCAA tournament kind of without expectations, you know, behind that great backcourt, and we're looking up and we're calling Damon Stoudemire. You know, if Larrañaga and Hamilton retire, Damon Stoudemire could be like the second best coach in the ACC next season.
One other roster move we should touch on. Might be a couple others. We have to get to like commitments wise, but one other kind of portally name, and this is related to the D.R. Johnson and that guys who can't pick a school. Marcus Adams. We said this was weird when it happened. But this is a kid. So Marcus Adams has now left Gonzaga. He's reportedly now visiting BYU. Marcus Adams is a reclassified 2024 high school kid who was going to go to Kansas, shows up to Kansas for like a week, decides it's not for him. Commits to Gonzaga. I don't think ever actually enrolled.
I saw that he did not enroll, which means he wasn't at practices, right? Like, you can't practice if you don't enroll.
Correct. Not sure he ever made it to Spokane. So he said that all the Gonzaga players were nice. I don't know if that... because apparently the Kansas players were not very nice. lots of big bullies out in Lawrence. But so now Mr. Adams is looking for school number three since, what, like mid-July? It's a bizarre saga. Whether he enrolls at BYU, he doesn't. He has the same issues that we wonder with Kansas. Would he be eligible? He's technically a transfer. He's not a high school kid. He's using his one-time transfer by going where he is. If he does have to sit. And like, at what point, like, yes, he's talented, he's top 50 recruit, but like, at what point you're just like, I'm not doing this. Like, how do you recruit a kid who has flip flopped twice in a summer?
I mean, this is borderline unprecedented, right? Like, With this quick time, you know, quick time frame, you know, we've seen guys like the aforementioned D.R. Johnson, where that saga played out over like 3 or 4 years. This is in like 6 weeks. Reclass, Kansas, Bale, Gonzaga, and like when he commits to Gonzaga, he's all like, oh, this is a perfect fit. Like, Kansas wasn't a good fit. Blah blah blah. And now he's on the move again. And yet, when I saw that BYU visit, I'm like, someone has to tell this guy to, like, chill out. Like, you know, take a deep breath and, like, take your time on this one. But I guess you got to enroll before classes start, or else you'll have to sit out a year in residence, right? So, like, if he didn't enroll until October, he would have to sit out, obviously, second semester of this year. And then, in theory, first semester of next year, right?
Yes.
So he's really up against it, so.
So some thoughts here. Number one, if you're going to – like, if there's a spot that, like, it makes sense, I think they'd be – BYU would be a good example of, like, yes, this is worth the risk. Number one, BYU needs access to talent. Marcus Adams is a top 100 recruit. Those are not very accessible to BYU, if they're, especially if you're not Mormon. Take a kid, roll the dice. Number two, especially in the Big 12. Number two, BYU has two scholarships, right? Like, if the kid shows up for a year, he doesn't like it, whatever, he leaves, who cares? We had spots to burn, particularly after the Quez Glover thing. They don't play the same position. We'll see. Third thought, Gonzaga did not really need this kid this year, right? They have guys like Steel Venters on the wing. They have Dusty Stromer. They have, you know, they were not like, oh my gosh, we have Anton Watson at the four, Ben Gregg. Like, they do not need, they weren't, this was not like a guy who was going to play 30 minutes a game as a freshman. So they can survive this. But I think he probably would have played if he was eligible. And if nothing else, again, he's just a top 75 recruit that you sit on your bench, and if he transfers in a year, he transfers in a year. You have spots. Gonzaga now has three scholarships open, and it does not seem overly likely at this point that they can fill any of them.
Right, because Caden Perry had to retire because of a back injury. Alex Tuhi, who was the predecessor to Marcus Adams as that backup wing, he went off to play, I think, back home in Australia.
It's just been a weirdly active offseason for Gonzaga. Like, this is not normal.
Right, they could use another guard and another wing. Another guard and another big. Maybe a wing, too. But in terms of the top end of the roster, I mean, it's rock solid. It's top 10 good. And we've seen guys like Hunter Salas and Martinez Arlauskas and stuff, who are these great recruits that kind of wither away on the bench. So maybe it's a good thing, you know, get Marcus Adams in a spot where I guess he'll play more. This has to be motivated by playing time, you'd think, to go from Kansas to Gonzaga to now BYU. But we'll see. I don't have much faith in his career the way this is going.
Any concern about Gonzaga's lack of depth?
I think you could use one more big. I mean, Graham Ike isn't even cleared yet, right?
Correct, to my knowledge.
I mean, if there's any big still out there that you could find, I mean, I guess just grab one.
Gonzaga classes start today. So.
And then you have like another week or so where it's like the deadline to enroll. Clock's ticking.
Maybe Malcolm Dandridge should have come after all. He's officially back at Memphis. So.
Yeah, I saw that. Another wacky recruitment.
He just skipped on the international trip. He's like, hey, you know what? I don't really want to practice for the summer. Which, honestly, respect. Enjoyed the summer, hung out, got a few recruiting calls, might have gotten some NIL. Good for him. Seton Hall picked up two players. This one literally just came across the wire, the second one. Malachi Brown, 2023 high school kid from Legacy Early Academy, which was on the NIBC circuit, but like by far the worst team in the NIBC circuit. This is a complete flyer. They also added a big guy from Turkey, Arda Ozdagan. I was told that Mr. Ozdagan is probably not a Big East level player from someone who's evaluated him a little bit, but you know, we're taking rolls of the dice here. If you're Shaheen Holloway, chances that either of them play this year, Brad, any?
Very small. I mean, at the five, they already got three guys they can go with, right? With Bediako, Hutchins Everett, and then Nganga.
That's right. Theoretically, Ozdagan could beat Nganga, who's been injured so much in his career.
And then in the backcourt, I mean, Richmond and Dawes are going to play so much.
And they have Jaquan Sanders, Jaquan Harris, and Isaiah Coleman.
Right. I bet Richmond and Dawes. Oh, I mean, Shaheen does substitute very liberally. You know, he's a big spread the wealth guy minutes wise, but I mean
this Malachi Brown kid. Like, if I hadn't added him to my depth chart just now, I literally might have like not noticed that he was there all season. Then he hit the portal and like on April 10th, I'd be like, who's this guy? I've never heard of him.
Exactly. Yeah, I had never heard of him before today.
His stats are relatively underwhelming on the NIBC circuit.
Do you want to touch on Michigan?
Yes.
Former Seton Hall role player Trey Jackson is one of, what, seven power forwards on this team?
So, yes, Michigan added Lee Aliyah from Argentina, who has become kind of an international man of mystery, if you will, after the FIBA U19 World Cup, got recruited by a bunch of high majors, including Providence, picks Michigan. There are a few things that you kind of notice with him. Obviously on film, he looks the part, big physical kid. He's also he's represented for NIL by Alex Siratsis. If that name is familiar, that's Giannis Antetokounmpo's agent. So he obviously has a good eye for talent. So when I see that Sarats is repping a kid internationally, I have like my ears perk up a little bit. Doesn't mean that he will be anything or won't be anything, but I do think from what I'd watched, like if he was going to a team that had a big need in the front court, I would be projecting that he could play minutes right away. But I don't quite understand where the minutes are coming from here unless Olivier is playing the three. Or unless Terrence Williams and Trey Jackson are completely cooked.
Right, like Ayala, yeah. The fact that he had to decide so late, I guess, because he didn't get the clearance until August. Everybody already had their bigs. And like there was more immediate time at Michigan at the five than Providence. But if he waited out the year at Providence and Oduro and McNair were gone, then he'd have, you know, as a sophomore, he'd be the starting center. Here at Michigan, he can fight for minutes right away, but he's still only one class behind Terrace Reed. And he's listed as a four, but, you know, he's more of like the Omer Yurt 7, you know, a little smaller than that, but, you know, Nate Watson-ish kind of guy. Has some skill, but is mostly just, you know, kind of like an interior scorer type, it seems like. But this Michigan team is interesting because, you know, we've been laughing about the weird roster construction with all the power forwards. But at the end of the day, like, because I saw that the three-man we've had them borderline top 25.
I was, like, baffled by that. Maybe not baffled, but I was, like, very surprised.
I had them 63.
Yeah.
And so something that I was considering even when ranking them at 63 is, you know, what if we're just overthinking this and like between McDaniel, Burnett, Reed, and Nakamon, they just have like four really good players, and then they, whether it's Llewellyn gets healthy or Terrence Williams or Trey Jackson's fine at the three, and they just have like just enough good players to put together a nice starting lineup, but. I don't know. I don't see the top 25-ish love.
So my big disconnect with Michigan is I don't understand at all where the Namari Burnett love is coming from. I liked Namari Burnett at high school. Thought he was an interesting player. But what has anyone seen in the last 3 years that like suggests that Namari Burnett is like a above average starter or even a starter in the Big Ten?
I mean, like, he's a now or never guy on my list.
He's shot 30, under 37% both seasons. He doesn't really do a ton for you defensively. He's not a great shooter. He shoots way more threes than twos. Like, what is the sales pitch here where, like, Namari Burnett becomes, like, a really – again, there's pedigree enough, as you said – that maybe he becomes like a big time bounce back and proves that he's a good player. But like, I look at this team as having the worst 2-3 combo in the Big Ten. That's Llewellyn and Burnett. That's worse than Terrence Shannon and Marcus Damask. It's worse than Trey Galloway and Mackenzie Mbako. It's worse than Josh Dixon, Patrick McCaffrey. It's worse than Deshaun Harris-Smith and Jordan Geronimo. It's way worse than Tyson Walker and Jaden Akins. I guess maybe it's not worse than Cam Christie and Josh Oladipo.
What's Penn State? Is that Raquandis Mitchell and Puff Johnson?
I had Zach Hicks at the three, Puff at the four, but sure. Maybe it might also, you know, I think like Tominaga and Bryce Williams is better than that duo. Tominaga's legit good. So it's at best 12 in the league. right? And as a 2-3 combo. So combo was really good. Terrace could break out. Unless I don't get the, like, that's a surefire NCAA tournament team unless you're really buying Doug. You're like, Doug is gonna be amazing. And they're thin, like, ball handle wise. I guess they're in the mix potentially to add a second Argentinian kid from that team who had good stats, like a 6'7" wing.
Oh.
So that maybe that could move the needle a little bit, but yeah, I would be closer to the 63 than like the 32, the three men we've had. I think I have them just outside the top 50. If you had them in the 40s, I don't think I'd argue, but I think the 30s is too high.
So I had a few other things. I mean, we can go to Georgetown. I mean, I don't understand kind of what happened here. Now, I think the top end talent on this team is good enough to keep him ahead of Butler and DePaul. But this isn't a top 100 team, I don't think. I mean, even with a cook is not that good. He's a spot up shooter who can't handle the ball, shoots like mid 30s. But now, yeah, five or six like nice solid players in here. Your best player is Jaden Epps, and then the name of the blog escapes me, but the Georgetown blog today. Like, yeah, Cooley's adding five walk-ons, just like loading up on all these kind of former D1 guards that have been kind of floating around, I guess. What happened here?
The NIL money that wasn't. Yeah. It is bizarre.
Seems like Cooley has sold the fan base on some patience.
Yes. It helps that he already has the 24 commitments and got them early. Right? I think there'd be a lot more angst if it was like, oh, we're in the final five for Kayvon Mulready right now, instead of like, we have Kayvon, we have Drew McKenna, we have Thomas Sorber, and then the guard, what's his name,
Caleb Williams.
Yes,
combo. Yeah. Forward, yeah.
That's right, combo. Like, if you didn't have those guys committed, or you had one or two of them, that'd be really scary.
I mean, this is probably the worst front court in the Big East. Definitely the worst five position in the Big East, right?
You think Supreme Cook is worse than Deshaun Nelson?
Yes, definitely.
I don't think there's Deshaun Nelson to think, but
is Supreme Cook worse than Jalen Thomas and Andre Screen? Which it seems like from the people who watched Cook play at their Kenner Summer League, the big DMV Summer League, that he didn't look so hot. That's kind of the vibe I'm getting there.
He was like the third or fourth best center in the MAC last year. So
if Alexis Yetten is healthy, I think you'd say Fairfield made out better than Georgetown.
I mean, he's not healthy, but yes.
I know. And then I've seen Drew Fielder play maybe three or four times. He doesn't play any defense at all, which would seem to be a non-starter for Cooley, so we'll see.
Right. I mean, again, the big problems are, number one, your best player is Jaden Epps. And number two, you have no depth.
Showing out with walk-ons. And Drew McKenna, it seems like with every report I read, people seem less and less confident he's actually making it to 2023. So I guess we'll see there. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, I'm good. We got to get to your list. Any other teams you had notes on, Brad?
Yeah, I'll go quick here. First, we had a blast from the past. I saw our guy Che Evans is going to JUCO. For those who don't remember, Che Evans was a top 250 recruit, committed to San Diego State, and then claimed he turned down like multiple hundreds of thousands play with the G League Ignite. which we clocked that it was nonsense. I think you even either wrote or tweeted about nonsense, and you were getting back and forth with his family, right? Or did I make that?
I had a back and forth with Lamont Butler's family.
Okay.
But Che Evans has been at three schools in 3 years, San Diego State, UTEP, and USC Upstate. He scored a total of 19 points in those 3 years. He's 6-for-26 from the field in those 3 years. He's played 15 total games in those 3 years. So I have no expectations that Mr. Evans will magically turn into a good college basketball player, but to JUCO it is.
It's one of the all-time just like wacky storylines that people ran with. That like, oh, he turned down like hundreds of thousands of dollars to play in the G League Ignite. But right, because at that time it was like Scoot Henderson, Jalen Green, Che Evans. The next thing I wanted to touch on, there's a lot of OMAX hand-waving going on. From like smart people, too. And they're eagerness to anoint Marquette either as the best team in the Big East or a top five team, or just I love Marquette. It's always, oh yeah, all they're losing is OMAX. No big deal. Just an NBA first round pick who was one of the most versatile wing defenders in all of college basketball. And I think people are right in saying that David Joplin is certainly good enough to be the starting power forward, to be a starting power forward on a good Big East team. But he's nowhere near the defender that OMAX was. And they don't have an OMAX replacement on the roster. You know, guys like Chase Ross, they're, what, 3-4 inches shorter than OMAX. So I'm just not quite as I'm certainly not as bullish as on Marquette as everyone else. I have them 12th. Most people right now are having them top five.
I mean, I think it's hard because Marquette returns four starters and five of their best six players.
From, really, eight of their top nine, basically, right, yeah.
From a top 10 team last year. There's no reason that anyone would get worse, and they have some breakout candidates. They weren't especially lucky, in my opinion, last year. Like, they looked the part. When they, you know, they earned everything. They won the regular season. They won the Big East tournament. And if Tyler Kolek doesn't get hurt, they probably beat Michigan State and probably go to the Final Four. But, you know, I think you're right. Like, OMAX's loss is being underrated a little bit, particularly given the fact that, like, they don't even have, like, that, like, a natural replacement on the roster, as you said. Like, there's no internal guy where you're like, oh, yeah, this guy can do some of the OMAX-y stuff. There's not – they didn't take a transfer. They didn't like, roll the dice with anything. I do think that, like, some of these young guys are going to be really good. Like you mentioned, Chase Ross, I think, has a chance to leap a little bit. I think Ben Gold has a chance to leap a little bit. I think Zaid Lowry is going to be a really good player for them. I don't know how good he'll be this year. But, like, I really liked him. And I liked Trey Norman, who, again, another guy probably blocked this year. But I thought Trey Norman has a chance to be really good when I saw him last summer. So I think just the overwhelming quality on this roster is enough for me to feel pretty good about them being – I don't think I had quite have them top five. I think I have, like, 6, 7, or 8, something like that. But I think, you know, if there's one concern, it's how are they going to defend. They're going to be small. You've replaced your best defender with one of your worst. That's concerning enough to be at least tracking.
And their biggest Achilles heel last year is probably on the glass. And they definitely got worse in that category.
Yes.
Two other things I just want to get off my chest. Another narrative that I've seen, I saw Tate was saying it on his podcast. I think Gary Parrish was saying it on their podcast. I see it a lot. I think I've seen it everywhere, maybe. Is that Kansas is the surefire number one? Where are we getting this? How is Kansas's talent level on a different level than that of like Purdue's or UConn or Michigan State or Arizona? Like, how are they head and shoulders above the competition? I don't understand that at all.
They're just like the easy one, right? Like they're old, they have talent, they have self. I actually think, and I'm going to wind up with Kansas as my number one, I think. Maybe I'm just too afraid to be different, but like, given what number one tends to really be, in the same way that you always, for a couple years there, you were just like, Gonzaga has to be number one.
Yeah.
I kind of think the same thing goes for Purdue.
I'm going with Purdue 100%.
Right? Like, Purdue's floor is probably like a 3 seed, right? Like the worst outcome that Purdue could have this year without Zach Edey like tearing an ACL is that like everyone shoots it as badly as they did down the stretch last year, and they're just like one of the two best teams in the Big Ten.
Right, because I don't think Kansas has as much talent as Duke. And in terms of proven commodities, I mean, Purdue's sitting right there. With their two freshman guards last year back, Edey is like the monster of all monsters. Whole front court's back. Yep.
There's a lot of excitement about Trey Kaufman Wren, by the way.
And Miles Coleman.
Yes. Miles being that like big time athlete, wing, can shoot a little bit, played USA basketball. I'll tease this. I'm working on a story about Purdue for Sports Illustrated. Won't go too much into detail because it won't be out until the basketball preview edition of the magazine. But I talked to Braden Smith last week, and he was talking very highly of Trey Kaufman. And I asked him, like, if he was not blocked by Zach Edey, like, what would he be? And Braden Smith said, Trey Kaufman Wren would be first team all Big Ten without a doubt in his mind.
We'll see, because he is blocked by Edey.
I think there's a world where he plays a lot of four this year.
Right, and you have Caleb first, you have Mason Gillis.
Oh, no doubt.
You got to find room for all of them, but
Paint has done this before. I mean, Paint has had to navigate these types of situations.
Yeah, with Caleb Swanigan and AJ Hammonds was one. And then, like, Caleb Swanigan and Isaac Haas. So yeah, a bunch of guys.
It'll be very interesting to see how it shakes out.
Yeah, I'm going Purdue at number one. And the last thing I want to get off my chest is I don't feel like people understand that San Diego State's roster is very different than last year. Right? Like, what was San Diego State this year? They were massive. They were long. They were athletic. They were physical. Right? They had Keyshawn Johnson at the four. They had Nathan Mensah at the five. They had Adam Seiko's big defender. They had I'm forgetting one of their a rope, right? 6'9", 6'10", like long, just playing volleyball off the glass. Looking at this roster, they're gonna be playing small, right? Like Tremell and Butler figure locks to start. Ladie's a lock to start.
Probably you would think Dixon Waters is a lock to start.
Yep, and then Micah Parrish at the four, or Jay Powell at the four. Probably Micah Parrish, but either way.
And Jay Powell is a waiver.
Oh. But they don't, like, maybe some of these younger guys are, like, big and physical, like DeMarche Johnson and Begun Gwath, but, like, Elijah Saunders is a skilled big. I think Miles Hyde's a skilled big. So they're going to be playing basically four perimeter guys.
Miles Bird is like a playmaking wing.
Yeah. So they're going to be playing four perimeter guys, really four guards around Ladie. That's correct. That's the exact opposite of what they did this year with playing two offensive rebounders and, you know, Matt Bradley, this big stocky physical wing, and, you know, this is a completely different team.
And it's not like we overly trust Discher to, like, run shit offensively and then be, like, beautiful on that end of the floor. Like, they do not play the best brand of basketball. Like, I think you can rank them because they're going to win 25 games because it's San Diego State. And they have a very good, very veteran backcourt with Tramell, Butler, Dixon Waters. Ladie's good enough. I like some of these young guys. I think Miles Bird's going to be a really good player for them. You mentioned Magoon Gwath. He's like a late reclass, long run, you know, rim running big. I'm kind of skeptical of what he does this year, but, you know, seems like he has a good future. But yeah, like, I do think, I mean, people don't quite seem to get that San Diego State has been top five in defense the last 2 years. They were top 10 in defense three of the last four. All that's with Nathan Mensah. You got to think there's a little bit of regression coming here. I know Steve Fisher's teams were elite defensively. Yes, Dutcher knows how to do it, knows how to scheme it. But it's going to be a little different. And their defense was, you know, really good running people off the three-point line, but also good at the rim. And without Mensah, I don't know how much that'll change.
I put them at 33, and that might be too high. We'll see. Talent level still pretty strong for the Mountain West. It's just a completely different team, roster, style of play, everything.
Yeah. All right, let's do your, what's it called?
Now or never, guys?
Now or never. Now or never.
All right. How about we start with guys whose star reputation are really in now or never, right? Like they were considered stars. They never proved it really, and now is basically their last chance to be a college basketball star. You'd think. So starting with Harrison Ingram, right? He was a potential first round pick at Stanford. He was on U19. Stanford was never good. He never popped as a first option. Now he's going to UNC where they need a rebound, and he's playing with a very talented group that could accentuate his skill set. And if he's not good this year, it's never going to happen. Run through mine, or did you want to comment on each one, or what?
I'll respond on the Harrison Ingram run briefly with, you could justify why Harrison Ingram wasn't breaking through at Stanford because Stanford was the wrong context. Carolina should be the right context. If he can't thrive in that context, he probably isn't that good.
Interject whenever. I'll just keep going here. Khalil Ware, again, USA basketball track record. He goes to Oregon. He's supposed to be able to shoot threes and block shots and everything. They have a million other bigs. He gets lost in the shuffle. Say that he has a bad motor. He's going to Indiana. Indiana's trying to get Derek Queen for next year. You know, they probably pitched him as being the one and done here at Indiana to be in the NBA next year. If he has another subpar year, he's just lost. It's not going to happen.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the whole thing with Khalil has been the talent has never been the problem. It's the motor, it's the work ethic, et cetera. And Oregon, despite having a not great team and lots of issues, basically shunned him and said, whatever, like, we're done. We don't need you. We don't need you to play as much as you're playing. And the fact that they did that and basically let him walk, it's a transfer, I think says something. And it's Khalil's time to prove it wrong. If Khalil proves it wrong, he could be a lottery pick in next draft.
Next, I got two Illinois guys here. Coleman Hawkins and Quincy Guerrier. So we'll start with Guerrier. When he was at Syracuse, he was, like, going to go to the NBA draft, and that, like, wasn't that crazy. Like, he probably wasn't going to be picked, but he was kind of in the mix. He was seen as a skilled forward who can play the small ball five. He could shoot a little bit. He was physical. He could rebound. He goes to Oregon, like Mr. Ware, gets completely lost, completely forgotten guy. Now he's at Illinois. He might not even start at Illinois. This is literally his last year, I believe, as well. So if he's going to regain that kind of Syracuse buzz, it's got to happen now.
I was gonna say he's out of eligibility, so it is in fact now or never for Mr. Guerrier.
And then Coleman Hawkins, who might be unfair because a lot of it was internet buzz, but you know, talking a big breakout last year, he came in just under 10 points a game, which surprised me. I thought that his scoring average was much higher, but his whole idea of being like this skilled forward is it's more flash than production so far, and this is the year to put it together. He came back. He could have been maybe a two-way guy in the NBA or something. He's got the size and the skill. He can handle the ball, and now it's time to take that step forward for Illinois.
Agreed.
Next, we got two Memphis guys here in their backcourt: Caleb Mills, Javon Quinterly. Caleb Mills obviously was the AAC Player of the Year as a freshman at Houston, I believe. And then since then, he's just not been able to recapture that season. And, you know, that was a kind of a symbolic team award, right, where Houston was so good and they had a bunch of really good players. He gets the nod. Doesn't work out at Houston, goes to Florida State, doesn't pop at Florida State. He's completely forgotten. And now it's the last chance. You know, people thought he was going to be a college basketball star. And here at Memphis, starting at the two guard, that's his last chance. Similarly, Quinterly, you know, he was good at Alabama, but, you know, he wasn't always starting. He was, what, their fifth or sixth best player last year, you'd say, behind Miller and Clowney and Sears and Bediako. And now this is his team at Memphis if they don't get DeAndre Williams. The expectations are high. A lot of people have Memphis certainly making the tournament, but like top 25-ish. And that's predicated on Quinterly being a best player.
Yeah, I mean, Alabama seemed to be better the less Quinterly played the last 3 years. So it's prove it time.
And next we got a couple of athletic wings here. Dylan Mitchell for Texas. Probably made the right move to come back to school. He's not as good as Jordan Walsh or, you know, some of those other Andre Jackson, those athletic non-shooting wings. And, you know, he's not going to have the ball in his hands a ton with Hunter and Asemus there, but he's really got to show he's an NBA prospect or he lost there. I mean, they have some veterans that seemingly fit the roster more like Adeel Horton. That could slide ahead of him too, so his position is not safe there. And then Baba Miller, who had a weird year because he was suspended for half of it, but he had so much hype as an international prospect. Might be more of a big than a wing at this point, and he didn't show any of it in a disappointing first year at Florida State.
Yeah, I think those are good ones in the sense of like their talent. Like, they will not stick around college basketball anymore if they don't produce this year. They probably won't stick around college basketball either anyway, but if they play poorly, they'll never be remembered.
And then lastly, for now or never star reputations, Dawson Garcia. Very promising first year Marquette. Was a terrific recruit. UNC plays better without him. Minnesota has had no success with him. He's supposed to be this, you know, versatile wing, inside out, 20-point per game guy. This, I mean, if not now, then when? For Dawson Garcia. Next, we can move on to the guys who are hoping that a change of scenery does the trick. So I had five guys here. Sky Clark for Louisville. I mean, he had the role at Illinois is a starting point guard. Didn't even make it a full year there. Louisville is seemingly handing him the keys. No one else can dribble. If he can't do it this year, not going to happen. Hunter Salas, he was buried on Gonzaga's bench. Now Wake Forest giving him the keys. Similarly with Damian Collins for LSU. You know, a lot of these Kentucky guys, is it a lack of opportunity, or were these guys as overrated as recruits? He should play a ton at LSU. And then Arterio Morris, good buzz so far at Kansas, but he was someone who was a guy that recruiting guys love, that draft guys love, and he was kind of a non-factor as a freshman at Texas. And lastly, Isaiah Miranda, who was seemingly run off at NC State for Ben Middlebrooks and Muhammad Diarra. Now he's going to an Oklahoma State team that needs some front court pop.
I don't think I would call your last two guys last chance. Maybe Miranda a little bit. But I don't know. I think there's a little bit more runway here for those guys.
I think more maybe the reverse, right? I think like if Arterio Morris comes out and averages 10 minutes a game this year, he's never going to be a starter at Kansas, right? They're just going to, add the next flashy transfer next year. And kind of like the Joe Yesufu situation. Whereas Miranda could stick around and kind of stick it out. But at least for reputation, I mean, he was such a good recruit. He declared for the NBA draft and nothing so far.
That's fair.
All right, next I'll rattle off these. Are we sure that they're actually good? I mentioned Namari Burnett before. Top 50 recruit, year three now, third different school, has yet to gain any real traction. He was kind of a bench guy at Bama and Texas Tech. Michigan needs him. Jordan Geronimo and Puff Johnson both had great NCAA tournament runs once upon a time, or singular games, and that kind of bolstered their reputation. We haven't seen it yet. A couple of big guys. Jamarian Sharp and Connor Vanover. Like Sharp, is it just stats? Or is he actually good? Western Kentucky's defense was horrible with the 7-6 shot blocker. And Connor Vanover, the analytics love him, but is that just kind of stuck to low major basketball? Like can that translate up? Jalen Worley for Florida State, a lot of Florida State guys here. Hasn't happened yet as a starting point guard. He's got the size. It's not that good. Samson Johnson, another guy super hyped. People talk about him as like a starter last year. He gets hurt, and we've seen nothing through 2 years. Mark Armstrong has been great in U19. He was not great last year for Villanova. And he's fighting an uphill battle for certainly a starting spot. Bryn Hunley Hadfield, I know you're not a fan, but again, he was a 5-star recruit. He reclassified, and he's on a terrible Louisville team. If he can't get minutes this year, that's it for him. And lastly, Jose Perez.
Jose, my man, it's time.
And then lastly, addition by subtraction, guys who. Seems like the conventional wisdom is either their team was better with them out or their team is better with them gone now. Caleb Love, obviously, is the big one. Going to Arizona now. People think he was the issue at UNC. Zach Fremantle. The long debate of whether you can play him and Dungy together. And now could be if you can play him and Usman together. Xavier didn't really fall off too much when he was out. Sevier Wheeler and Paul Mulcahy for Washington. The Mulcahy might be retroactive Rutgers hate after he spurned them, but something I've seen a lot, that Rutgers might be better without him. He doesn't shoot well enough. He makes too many mistakes. Wheeler, we know, kind of got benched for Kentucky. People were begging for him to be benched the whole year. Jared Bynum, I've been begging for him to be benched forever. He stunk. It's going to be Stanford starting point guard. That'll be a big reputation one. John Hughley picked up better. seemingly when he was out. And then last but not least, Arthur Kaluma, who I'm sure a lot of Creighton fans are banging their head against the wall with him. So that was my list of now or never, guys. Any last thoughts on that?
Yeah, I like that group because it's a lot of guys where some people will blame the context for their struggles, right? Oh, Kaluma couldn't shine at Creighton. You know, he's blocked by, you know, all these other, you know, good players. Oh, you know, Jared Bynum didn't have, like, if Jared Bynum was on a team that had a little bit more firepower around him, he would have looked good. You know, Providence was failing down the stretch because of Ed Cooley, not because of Bynum. You know, yada yada yada. So, I like that group because I think we're probably right on most of them, but they get the opportunity to prove us wrong.
Anything else?
I think we're good.
Shorter episode, right?
Yeah, that's good stuff. We gotta keep them tight before we get these conference previews going in a couple weeks and really just talk for 2 hours on end. So we appreciate you bearing with us this offseason, folks. It's been a lot of fun, lots of movement. Looking forward to getting a little closer. If you're a college football fan, this is a big week. Week one of college football season. Enjoy it. Enjoy being back on college campuses, tailgating, being around the energy of it, the student section, the camaraderie, all of it's great stuff. And it's coming to college basketball in a couple months, but we'll have our placeholder at football this weekend. Enjoy your Labor Day weekends coming up this weekend, and see you all next week.